Welcome back. How are you doing, Joe?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, we have a lot to discuss this week. A lot of, I guess you could say, maybe small stories that give us an insight into the bigger picture. So we're not going to talk about some like a historical event or some dramatic event or some reinterpretation history. We'll talk about some of these small events that give us a view, a look into like the whole our corrupt system. The first thing, was this incident. This occurred, I think, in August, where two drivers, teen drivers, as they're described, intentionally ran over a retired police officer, I think a police chief. I think this was in Las Vegas. And these two geniuses recorded the event and their joy in running over the guy. The guy was left for dead and he died. They've since been arrested, but you can watch it on video if you'd like. It's pretty disgusting. They say, run his ass over, and they do it, and they're laughing. And of course, they are subsequently arrested. Of course, these are two BIPOCs, persons of color. And of course, no outrage. We didn't, I think the local press originally reported as a retired cop killed in bike accident. Of course, accident
Right.
is not accurate. Now that might have been they didn't have all the information yet because the video hadn't been released. I'm gonna maybe give them the benefit of the doubt, but it definitely is underplayed. This story and of course the black crime wave that is sweeping the country, not only because of the whole Summer of George 3 years ago, but also the wave of illegal immigration that is being facilitated by our treasonous federal government and its related agencies. Most telling, of course, we have this brutal crime. And this is a disturbing phenomenon. I'll let you comment on this, where we have a black on white crime or colored on white crime committed, person stabbed here, or woman raped here, shot to death here, and the relatives are brought on and they express a feeling of forgiveness towards the perpetrator, and they urge the public not to infer any racial motivations here. I think this the daughter of this police chief went had a press conference out there, and she said we shouldn't consider this part of the culture war. From that, I gather she meant like the racial issue. But however, black and white crime is a serious issue. It's a real thing that doesn't get enough press because we're told we're supposed to be all only concerned about racism, meaning white power, white supremacy, these things. But it is a disturbing phenomenon that you see, and apparently this is a coordinated public relations effort carried out by government agencies to sort of handle the PR and the response to this to prevent any ethnogenesis from occurring from this or any recognition of the white majority that they're indeed being targeted not only for criminal activity but for replacement. You have any comments here?
Well, I think that if someone wants to get the full scope of the tragedy and the cultural destruction that the whole process represents, you've got to see both videos. You have to see the video of the teens going out of their way to run the guy over, and you can hear the laughter. Bear in mind, this wasn't their first episode. They'd done this a number of times. This was just the first time someone had died and they got caught. But
It's a
this was just,
stolen, they steal cars and they run people over.
joyriding, and they go out and run over people for fun. And so you have in their behavior, you have the fruits of the great society, right? These, you couldn't get humans just to such a debased state in a single generation. I mean, these are really animals, and they have been, their background has been systematically arranged to produce these kinds of, they're human beings biologically, but they have no empathy whatsoever. They don't have the slightest concern or feeling for anything that is human. Okay, so that is, a truly destructive force in our world, and it has to be checked. And then watch after that the statement that the daughter of the victim gives. You sent me the tape, and I was just shocked and horrified because she's kind of, first of all, her words are really an insult to the death of her father. You know, it's as though he doesn't merit anger, you know, his murder. We shouldn't have any kind of emotional reaction. But Tim, the part that just I thought was the worst is just her tone of voice, because it's just so mechanical. I mean, she could be giving a lecture on, you know, the benefits of transgenderism to, you know, a group of eighth graders as a teachers union representative. I mean, it's just there is a complete disconnection between the normal human connections of father and daughter, right? So on one hand, you have the disconnection between humans that the Great Society programs have achieved in the first video. And then in the second one, you have the disconnection of the family connections, which are essential, right, for civilization and for just human experience to be, you know, positive. And they're missing too. So you really have, with the two videos, you've got good, you know, documentation of the process of dehumanizing that's going on. And this will shortly link up with the genetic alterations. You know, they've got the transvection now as an established medical procedure so they can get at the genes. They obviously has all the, you know, like debasing chemicals in our foods and in our environment. So you can see where this goes. I mean, this is the Epsilon class being created in real time.
Yeah, this type of response, this is something, a disturbing phenomenon that you know that I've noticed in these instances where a horrible crime is committed, usually against a ethnic white by a person of color, whether it's an illegal immigrant or a black person, black man, usually black male, and that, you know, the crime is usually very violent and heinous. The person may either be an illegal alien, shouldn't be in the country, or is on parole or was released because of criminal justice reform or something, because they too many black bodies in prison. Evidently, looking at the crime stats, they're probably too few. Sorry. Apparently, this type of response isn't organic, although a lot of it is sort of emergent behavior from white guilt. People need a virtue signal. They feel compelled. And again, this isn't Christian mercy she's demonstrating. It's cowardice. And it's virtue signaling. It's status seeking, and that's one thing where white people are very vulnerable to is the seeking of or the maintaining of status. And so you want to come out and virtue signal publicly in these things. A situation like this, where rage and a cry for vengeance would be fully justified, more natural and much more healthy, I think, because there is a purpose for anger in situations like this. It signals that this type of behavior not be tolerated, and there will be a price to pay, and that will then turn around and limit the amount of incidences like this from occurring again. When you come across as being forgiving, you're inviting more of the stuff, especially coupled with the overall, you know, the agitation, racial agitation that we see that the system is producing, the schools, the media, government, corporate America. So there's an atmosphere or feeling out there they can get away with this, and you know, the white people have it coming.
Well, Jim, how are you ever going to stop the violent, this kind of violence, if you don't have an anger and a righteousness?
You won't, and that's the whole thing. And this is something you've seen. Again, there's a organization comes up, the Department of Justice, called the Community Relations Service, which apparently is dispatched to these areas where a crime has occurred to control their reaction. They say it's to, they call themselves America's Peacemaker, to make sure there isn't any outbreak of violence. But it's there to prevent any ethnogenesis or group identity from coalescing or forming in response to, you know, these black and white crimes. At the same time, it does nothing to prevent the racial agitation surrounded around some, like a George Floyd incident, you know. So you'll have a situation where a young girl is raped and murdered, you know, by an illegal immigrant from Guatemala or Honduras or Senegal, and they'll come in there, they'll tell the survivors not to say anything provocative or emotional. And from what I understand, threats are often made. I've heard anecdotal stories of that. Whereas in a situation, if you have a black assailant or a black suspect being handcuffed by the cops, and he breaks free and then tries to get in a car and drag the cop away and is shot, there's a riot ensues. And then we're, and you know, there's a call for justice for the victim, even though the victim is actually the assailant. So it's completely, usually completely two different scenarios. Like a good example, what happened in, you know, in Missouri, which it causes, you know, a few years ago in 2015, which resulted in the Black Lives Matter being created. That was a George Soros event. There, to exploit that event, Michael Brown assaulted the police officer, and you had the hands up story, which was completely false. Doesn't matter if it's false. People still repeat it. It simply doesn't matter to these people. Corey Bush, the congresswoman, the low IQ congresswoman from, I think she's from Missouri, still repeats it, even though it's simply been debunked. It was debunked by the Obama Justice Department. So this is the case. But my point is, this community relations service is there to control, quote, control the event.
Right. Remember, they're part of the very, it's a very simple project to describe. They're promoting Black violence.
Yes.
They're promoting it in many, many different ways. And they are intimidating whites to accept the violence as just part of culture. Mm-hmm. So what this has the effect of, reducing the whites psychologically in their status, you know, and that they don't really, just like this girl, right? They don't see some kind of righteous violence is or justice as any kind of response that's appropriate. So we have a broad scale social control being implemented through intimidation. At least intimidating Europeans, people of European descent, to never think of violence as any kind of a response or any sort of ethnic kind of component to this structure. But the Blacks are definitely being triggered, deliberately triggered. So you look at the EU statistics on immigration, and you'll see that only less than 8% were women. Less than 8% were women over the last 12 months.
So young men are being imported into
Europe.
They're
young men, right. So they're importing, you know, young men who have no mates. They're inserting them into European culture. Now, what do you think is going to happen? What is the only outcome? There's going to be rape and violence.
Yeah.
And there's going to be destruction of European culture. So this is a worldwide phenomena against the Europeans that's just going on everywhere.
Yeah. Well, this is something you see in Europe, United States, and the backdrop of this is white guilt. And simply that the white countries, the European countries, North America, don't have the capacity or the right to defend their border because of white guilt. And so they have a problem even of vocalizing a problem. Like, so when you have like thousands of immigrants, male illegal immigrants from Senegal pouring into the United States or to Africa, we're not supposed to be taken aback by that. In fact, if you voice concern about that, you're a racist. You know, and this is silly, obviously. It's a manipulation of our emotions. It's a violation, obviously, of the country's sovereignty and the trust that we're supposed to have in our government. But it's being done anyway. Enoch Powell, the British statesman, gave a speech in the late 60s. They called the Rivers of Blood speech. And he talked about this because that's when mass migration from the West Indies and the Third World into Europe and to Britain particularly occurred after 1948. But really kicked in the 80s and 90s when the Tony Blair government, they said they were going to rub the noses of the working class in diversity. It was intentional. Of course, the lady that headed up the immigration policies were Barbara Roche, who happened to be Jewish, of course. So, wow. Same thing you see. That's another constant you see in this issue. But again, what we have here, and I think it was Enoch Powell, who said the whole point of government and politics is the avoidance avoiding unnecessary evils. I mean, that's the practical, that's why we have politics, have government, and we have these people in these positions, but it's violating that trust. Or you have a situation in government is violating its basic duty. Joe Biden, the Biden administration is a part of this. Of course, it didn't begin with him. It began in earnest after 1965. Really, the effects kicked in after 1986 with Ronald Reagan and amnesty, with illegal immigration. And this is part of the objective. But getting back to the whole white guilt thing, of course, the consequences when you talk about importing 92% of these illegal immigrants that are pouring into the countries are males, single males. Same thing in the United States of immigration. The practical effect of of not enforcing laws, and also of obsessing over the race issue, and unleashing or making white communities vulnerable to black crime through things like white guilt and integration, is high crime and their reaction to it. And they're controlling the response to it by pretty much by the racial narrative, meaning white guilt. We have no white people, ethnic whites have no interest, have no identity. And it's all about assuaging or compensating brown and black people, for the injustices visited upon them in history. We see this. I mentioned this to you a few years ago. There was a child that was thrown from a balcony of Mall of America. He landed like 40 feet below onto a hard surface, was grievously wounded. He apparently has recovered or is recovered. I don't know if he ever recover from it, but he didn't die. But the man who did it was a black man, an immigrant who had found his way to Minnesota, of all places. And he just threw the kid, we were told not to infer any racial motivations for this crime. But if immigration laws and criminal justice system had worked, he wouldn't have been there to throw that kid off the balcony. Nevertheless, the mother was interviewed, and she said after the incident and everyone was helping the child, all she wanted to do was forgive the man who did this. She did the interview, and that's a sick response. No anger. It's her child, for God's sake. And this guy threw this little kid, this little boy, a four-year-old boy, off the balcony. And her first impulse is to, again, express to the media her capacity for forgiveness. By the way, it's not up to her to forgive him. It's up to God, maybe the kid. He doesn't have the capacity to do that. He's lying unconscious.
Well, I mean, okay? theology is interesting and, of course, important, right, at this point. But it's really also just a matter of self-defense, culturally self-defense.
Well, first of all,
how are you going to prevent the action from occurring over and over again?
You won't. Where's the kids?
And Tim, bear in mind that kind of violence is then reflected in the event we were discussing. Yeah.
Here's another question: where's the kid's father? Was there a father?
Daddy? No, he.
Well, another thing is, it's a white mother who seemed with it. I mean, middle class. I'm assuming there's a father. Maybe the product of divorce, maybe illegitimacy. Maybe they didn't bother to interview the father, because what would the father want to do? He want to kill the MF-er, right?
He wanted to defend his child.
Yes, and by the way, that rage, that thirst for vengeance, is very male, and it's necessary in protection of the community. You effeminize you make the community effeminate and emasculate it. It's far more vulnerable to this type of behavior. That's where you're seeing that agenda across the board culturally. The emasculation of society, the reduction of the role of the father, males in general, particularly white males. And you see that reaction. So they all this want a virtue signal. There was another incident. This is another pathetic incident. This was a few years ago. This was back in the 90s. Amy Beale was an American in South Africa who was she went there to oppose apartheid. Not your country, woman. But anyway, she went to the virtue signal, and she was at an anti-apartheid protest, and she was set upon by a gang of black youths who bludgeoned her to death. And they were arrested, and they laughed at her trial when the description of the crime, they laughed at it, and they were sent to prison. But then they were released under reconciliation. And then apparently a foundation was created in her name, devoted to reconciliation in South Africa. And that foundation employed her murderers. And the parents, go to South Africa, they built a monument to her, and they hugged her killers.
Yeah.
Again, well, not Christian mercy. That's cowardice. That's vanity.
Right. And then if you look at the, authoritarian personality, the chapter 23, where they describe the project, you can see that this is where we are being led. Mm-hmm. You get rid of, or you define as neurotic and inappropriate all necessary strengths of a culture, right? The authority that a male would have, ethnocentric, kind of pride. I mean, if these things are neurotic and if they're replaced by pornography, right, which is of course, anti family moral structure. Well, where are you going to go, Tim? What does this actually lead you to? And I would think that all of the things we're talking about are being subtracted from the culture. The strengths needed to resist this kind of violence, they're being taken away. And so you're going to have, the European will be held in check by kind of overlords, typically that will be, stand-ins for the Judeo-Masonic leaders and rulers, but they'll be people of color, mixed race, mm-hmm. And this is just being done by design to produce ultimately, when you combine that, when you combine the kind of race mixing that these people are affecting with the destruction of the physiology, right, and psychology, then what do you have when you get to the end of it? You really think it's a worker's paradise, right? It's just a collection of individuals that'll be led into oblivion. That's all that they'll be useless. They will have no skills, or they will be stupid. They will be oversexed, overviolenced. They will have no meaning whatsoever, nothing to the people that created them. They will be, it's like when Naylor talks about the immigrants are being taken to hotels where we make sure they have all their vaccinations, right? It's just like a dog pound. This is where these people are going to end up. They think that they're on the road to some kind of Disneyland, where, their sexuality is worshiped, and, there's money from the, reparations coming from every different directions. They're just being taken right into the furnace of oblivion. And that's the thing that I think would be the most useful information to get to the people who are the agents of this technique, is to tell these immigrants, look, you aren't being brought here to ultimately have, a better life. You're being brought here to destroy the Europeans that you're going to encounter, and then yourself.
Yeah. The whole point of pouring them into the country is you can't have a conversation with a mob. So the situation here is like that. The guy who was murdered out in Las Vegas by the two teens driving the stolen car is, way this will be portrayed to the American public, is say if Hollywood were to make a movie about this, it would have portrayed the victim as black and the two assailants as two white rednecks riding a pickup truck. And that's how it would be portrayed, because that's the narrative Hollywood creates. I know this because they did this already. This is in 1996. There's a movie called A Time to Kill. It was based on a John Gresham novel. And it's about a 10-year-old girl, black girl, who was raped and left for dead by two white rednecks in a southern town. And what happens is the father, enraged, goes to the courthouse where they're being arraigned and murders his daughter's assailants. And he also wounds a deputy. And he's put on trial for murder. And it's a legal drama. And, with Matthew McConaughey, Sandra Bullock, Kevin Spacey. It was, it didn't do that well, but it was popular. Critics didn't like it, but it was well received at the box office. So that's the narrative. This enraged black father whose daughter's raped by two white guys. Now, the incident of white on black rape is almost non-existent in the country. Nevertheless, this is the narrative. The funny thing is, the story itself, the book that John Gresham wrote, was based on a true story, a real thing. That's what John Gresham says. It was a case in 1984 where two girls were raped by a man. And he was, I think, at a courthouse when the guy was being raped, and heard the story and inspired his book. The only problem is the book and the movie switches the races of the victims and the assailant. In reality, the assailant was a black man and the victims were two white girls. In the movie, the victim is a black girl and two white guys. switcheroo, isn't it?
Well, yeah, a little bit
of difference there. The politics is different, and
the indispensable kind of bedtime companion for people curious about these statistics that uses Chicago, but there is other cities you can get at, is Hey Jackass. It's yes. Online. Anyone can just go and look at this. Hey Jackass, and you want to see the statistics. of murder and crime. I mean, it's 95% people of color, mm-hmm. right? And the whites are just not even really a statistical kind of element in this thing. And yet then the movies and the politicians, you know, who like try to make, you know, capital out of this, that's all they can talk about is this like tiny, you know, irrelevant aspect of violence statistically, which is like white on black. Most of the white crime would be on other whites. So I would say, like, as a component of crime, white on black would be one in a, in Chicago, just looking at the numbers, it'd be one in a thousand, one mm-hmm. in a thousand. So there you have it. This is propaganda.
Yeah. And I was watching, it was a clip. I didn't see the entire movie. It just pointed out to me there was a remake of Death Wish with the Charles Bronson movie from the 70s. At least in the 70s, in that movie, some of the criminals were black.
Right.
In the remake, right. I didn't see the entire movie, so I can't say if other criminals were portrayed as black. But this one scene is he intercedes in an attempted carjacking. And the carjackers, the assailants, are two middle-aged, like, white guys.
Yeah, that's...
You know how we're out there trying to steal cars?
It's a very common bad habit.
I mean, what, security cameras? It's always white guys. You can tell by the way they're walking.
A Quentin Tarantino, you know, where it's just complete fantasy propaganda.
Yeah.
You cannot find two white middle-aged carjackers if you scan the whole country. You wouldn't find any. So to represent this as, kind of a fictional portrayal of reality, it's just propaganda. That's all it is. The people who produce these things, they know what they're doing. They're psychologically, you know, kind of trying to befuddle and damage Europeans, and they're trying to incite violence on the part of particularly Black Americans.
Did you see that? I sent you the news story. Or Attorney General Merrick Garland was, I think it was before the House Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
And he was being asked why his FBI, the Justice Department, was apparently harassing or targeting traditional Catholics, as they say. And, you know, the memos with the FBI memo describing these traditional Catholics as domestic extremists or terrorists. And Merrick Garland responded very emotionally, and saying that, reminding the committee that he had relatives who died in the Holocaust. His grandmother apparently escaped the Holocaust. Now, that wasn't relevant to the question. But, I mean, are we to infer from that his DOJ is targeting Catholics because he's a survivor of Holocaust victims? That he's a...
Of course, you have the two categories. You have Holocaust denial and the powerful psychological structure that is. And then you have the hidden one of Holocaust revenge, which is sort of dog whistle. They don't talk about it. But whenever you have Leo Frank,
yeah,
of course, before, but just as a structure, you know, you can see that whenever you get, Jewish people sort of caught in the act, well, you know, if they can't escape or use Holocaust denial as a charge against the people who've caught them, they can always say, well, I did it, but it's Holocaust revenge. So they just can't be wrong. And no matter what they do, it's...
Well, he actually said that. He said he was outraged that because his grandmother and his presumably relatives died in the Holocaust and his grandmother barely escaped the Holocaust, the idea that he as a Jew would ever engage in religious persecution is an insult. I don't follow that. But apparently what he's saying is Jews, because of their victim status, their privileged victim status, if you will, can never be suspected of engaging in any, ethnically or religiously motivated, activity, targeting other groups. Meaning, you can infer from his answer, what he's saying from his answer, because he invoked the Holocaust, that question, a specific question about targeting Catholics, Christians, Catholics, that they were targeted because they were Christian, because he immediately brings up his Jewish identity using the Holocaust, of course, as
Right. Well, yeah, you know, you have the whole religious chosen people sort of meme that gets rolled out.
How dare you accuse me? I'm Jewish. Basically, that's his posture. Right. I'm Jewish. How dare you accuse me?
It might be a useful thing. I mean, it's hard to say, but you know, you have all of the letters of the Zionists that Nirmer Sala went to the trouble of compiling in the expulsion of the Palestinians. Really a great read. You know, anyone who wants to like counter Garland's kind of moral position, you could just sit there and read from the letters of these famous Zionists in their description of the Palestinians, mm-hmm. which are, you know, the most race. You would never find Nazis writing about Jews in this. There's none. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but I don't think there's a single example of anything this heinous as the way they describe kind of the animal nature of the Palestinians and the fact that violence is fine. We're going to have to be, you know, murder or get rid of all these people, you know. You know, you could just use their own words to counter the sophistry, because the fact is, it's just the opposite. That, and you know, this would be kind of an interesting, I mean, it would be a broad sociological study. I'm not sure how you can conduct it. But I would say that, particularly among kind of like Zionist level Jews, that you would have like, if they answered a survey, you know, that was laid out carefully, they would be the most racist and the most justifying of violence in sort of as under kind of bizarre explanations of self-defense of any group. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure if that's true, but I think that would be certainly a really interesting survey to see what the results would be, because it would completely expose the position of the American political class, particularly the American Jewish political class, that's always kind of like, there's no way we could be doing anything bad because we had these terrible things done to us. And they don't say, well, we're not doing bad things. They're just saying we can't be accused of doing bad things. You see, yes. they don't want to go in. Well, let's have a you know, clear discussion, bring out the facts and evidence, sort of like in the Leo Frank trial as an example, right? Mm-hmm. No, they don't want to do that. They just want to bring out the sophistry so that stops the discussion. That's really what their language is designed to do. That's what these expressions are designed to do.
Yeah, they can't.
Anti-Semitism. They're not Socratic. They're not saying, hey, we've got a good argument here. We really want to go into the facts and details. They're saying, stop talking, stop thinking, stop the process of like trying to analyze what the reality is.
Yeah, and if they can't get around up through their sophistry, they're willing to like impose the law and put people in jail.
Merrick Garland.
Yes. You know, but again, I think Benjamin Netanyahu would argue that no crime has ever been committed against the Palestinian people because they don't exist, because there's no Palestinian state.
Right.
They don't. There's no Palestine. Therefore, Palestinians don't exist. That's literally his argument. I was like, well, that's interesting. Then prior to the formation or creation of Israel in 1948, can we say that Jews don't exist? Therefore, no crimes against Jews that can ever have occurred.
Well, therefore, the Holocaust doesn't exist.
Holocaust doesn't exist. Follow that logic. But then again, it's not a question of Socratic logic, sophistry, right?
Yeah, it's all
opinion of the powerful. They have the power to impose it. There was that Elon Musk, because he has this run-in with the ADL, and then Benjamin Netanyahu comes to the country to meet Elon Musk, and they have the summit, if you will, and they're discussing these things. And because Bibi's being portrayed as the rational Jew in the room, counterpoise to the ADL, that's something else. Bibi's the moderate compared to Greenblatt's ADL, and he says that that Twitter or Twitter X must be able to combat anti-Semitism within the confines of the First Amendment. Well, that means you have to tolerate, because it's free speech.
Right.
I mean, what you define as anti-Semitism is criticism of Jews. There's good criticism, there's meaningful criticism of Jews, and there's hateful and irrational criticism of Jews.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'm very sensitive to this. I mean, you know, look at some of the books I've written. You can see, you know, don't want to see anti-Semitism as a real thing promoted for irrational reasons. I think I can honestly take that as a part of my worldview. But I, you know, when I look at the actual facts on the ground of our current reality, Tim, I don't see anti-Semitism anywhere. What I see is like legitimate criticism that gets swept under the rug with the brush of this term anti-Semitism. Where is anti-Semitism? Where, you know, they have like, well, there are groups that like hate Jews, but then they turn out to be FBI agents.
Yeah, like JDL or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, okay, well, like, well, let's do a research. Where's the real, I want to find the real anti-Semite so we can like bring them out and beat them up and say, look, here's an anti-Semite. We don't like this individual. I can't find one. All I can find are like FBI agents and then an ADL subterfuge to like promote the idea that there was anti-Semitism, but there just isn't any. It's just, at this point, the whole anti-Semitic meme is, it's still powerful, but it's absolutely ludicrous. You know?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the ADL, its fundraising strategy is not only to make, you know, overblown false accusations of anti-Semitism. That obviously there's a conflict of interest there if you're relying on the ADL to report on the matter when their whole existence base is based on the existence of it and the exaggerated, you know, view of it. But also to go out and also to either encourage actually pay groups to go out and you know, like the Nazis to show up with the tattoos on the face and say the most outrageous things in public, you know, it's to me, it's pretty obvious at this point. I mean, it's to have, you know, proxies or fake groups go out. Yeah.
Oh, there you are. I thought I lost you, brother.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I mean, at this point, it's almost boring.
Yeah, well, it's so repetitive. But you know, the thing is, even though it's a subject we talk about, we have to talk about it because it's swept under the rug.
Well, all they do is talk about the Holocaust nonsense. And if they're going to do that, if you're going to talk about it, people are going to think about it. Then they say, you can't think about it. Right? You can't talk about it. Well, you keep bringing it up, so we're going to scrutinize your narrative. Exactly. Good example. Is this a story that Anthony Blinken, Secretary Anthony Blinken, tells a story of his father who wrote a book about it. His father claimed that he escaped Auschwitz and made his way across the German countryside and was liberated by a Negro American tank.
Wait! This isn't the same escape from the Holocaust that you talked about earlier.
Well, this is. He tells.
It's
of course, it's not.
Escape?
It's not true. There's no tank battalion in the area.
I mean, I thought these camps were tightly controlled, but there's like they're leaking sieves. You know, the people are escaping right.
Like
and
I
left.
Said, it doesn't matter if it's not true. It's a good story, you know. But then he thinks he can just tell the story and get away with it, even though it's incoherent. It's ahistorical. It's true. It's a lie. And E. Michael Jones made a case that if you're going to have Holocaust denial laws, then you have to have Holocaust liar laws too. One go with the other. You can't have people lying about it, and he's lying about it, or at least he's passing on a lie. He's knowingly passing on a lie, which is lying, you know. And this is done in jest, but I said about Anthony Blinken's story. He says Anthony Blinken tells a story where his stepfather was able to overpower the eagle and the bear that had been placed in a cage with him and escaped to the woods that surrounded the concentration camp. He then was adopted by a pack of wolves that assisted him in his journey west across the German countryside. He ended up in Bavaria, where he ran into an American Negro tank battalion. The commander of the tank battalion was none other than Martin Luther King Jr. Blinken was so overjoyed by his liberation, he shouted, "God bless America," and then defecated 6 diamonds, which he then gave to his liberators as a token of his gratitude.
You've combined a lot of different stories. You've combined a lot of different Holocaust escape stories into one. That's interesting.
All those are a mixture of different stories that we are told are true. And if you question any of those stories, you're, according to Deborah Lipstadt, you're guilty of Holocaust denial.
Yeah, I wonder if any of the stories about the escape are real. You know, it's like we talked about like Anne Frank, you know, the story of that came out about her and stuff. And
yeah,
I mean, it depends on how you mean by reality. I mean, certainly I think the person existed and I think they were in that house, but everything else just seems to be propaganda. When you start digging into the details, it just becomes more and more impossible to believe any of it.
Her father was a crook engaged in criminal activity.
Holocaust escape stories. you know, and you start trying to find citations and, you know, like, well, or even just plausibility, you know, well, you go, well, wait a second, they went from here to there in winter. You couldn't do that. It's at night. There would be, you know, you'd freeze to death. I mean, you end up with stories if you start getting the details that are just ludicrous.
Well, Elie Wiesel, Night, that's taught as canon.
Yeah.
Kids. They're told to read that and it's all fake. It was cleaned up by a French author who made it a readable book and it was bestseller. And students are made, like Anne Frank's Diary, they're made to read that. And even Catholic students are made to read that. And of course, the conclusion of the book is Elie Wiesel is God died at Auschwitz. You're teaching Catholic kids that God died at Auschwitz. Why are Catholic students reading that stuff? And it's lies. He himself admitted that he, at the camp, he had an option of staying and being liberated by the Red Army or leaving with his German captors, his tormentors. And he left with his German tormentors. Why did he do that? Doesn't make any sense. Left with his sick, I think, father or brother. I think father at the time. So they weren't being killed there. He left with them. They had to escape west because of the advancing Red Army. It doesn't make any sense. And he never mentions gas chambers. To him, there was pits of flames. Flame pits going hundreds of feet into the air, which is ridiculous. He never mentions gas chambers. Is he a Holocaust denier?
Yeah, I mean, Wiesel's, you know, the stuff that kind of rings true, like the fact he left with the, you know, the German captors, or the Germans at the camp. I mean, it just directly contradicts the fantasy propaganda aspects. It's one of these stories. I mean, it just happens time and time again where you get into these Holocaust stories and you start trying to, you know, parse out the real from the propaganda, and the whole thing just disassembles.
Yes.
I mean, Wiesel's idea that the camp was this death factory, and then he leaves at the end with his with the Germans rather than wait for the Russians to show up. What? It just makes no sense. So the what makes sense is that the first part of the story is fantasy and it's just propaganda. Now suddenly the historical aspects start to come forward and they kind of can fit into one's, you know, a reader's mind, you know, coherently. But you cannot look in these stories very carefully without them just completely falling apart. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just propaganda. It's even like Eisenhower's kind of description of what happens immediately after the war and his portrayal of, you know, this vast horror that he's seeing, but he doesn't parse from that the fact that there was all of the starvation because of Allied bombings.
Yeah.
Right. He just ascribes all of the carnage to the Germans. Oh, it has to have been from them. There's no kind of nuance, even though the facts are just self-evident. This all goes by the boards because it's propaganda that is coming forward. Propaganda.
Yeah. And it feeds into established prejudices that have been fed by previous propaganda. And the whole notion becomes a sort of congealed World War II propaganda, whether it's Hitler, the Third Reich, that whole event. And then into that sort of meme is all this PR, whether it's Elie Wiesel's Night, the Holocaust movies, you know, the hundreds or not thousands, if not tens of thousands of Holocaust movies, whether factoring into like either the plot or the subplot, you know, these things. Like I remember I was watching one of these hokey monster scary shows, like they were carried on the like WB network. And there was a story of a vampire on a train in Germany in the 1930s. It was Dracula or something, a Dracula-like character. And it's sort of like an interview with the vampire.
Yeah.
And the vampire is explaining his worldview and his outlook and why he does what he does, and which is somewhat interesting, I guess you could say, if it's well written. And all of a sudden, there's a scene where he hungers for blood, so he goes to seek a victim. And there's this young man he runs into in his 30s. And he's about to, he talks to him, and he's about to set upon him and suck his blood. And it turns out that the young man is Adolf Hitler. And the vampire detects in Adolf Hitler someone more evil than him, and he rejects him as a victim.
There you go. There you go. Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Right. Well, I mean
I saw him, someone more evil than I, than the devil himself. I mean, wow.
You know, you think about the trajectory of this from the pawnbroker,
yeah,
right? That level of propaganda, which is, you know, subtle and, you know, just kind of setting the Gentiles up, you know, to like accept propaganda as reality. I mean, basically, you know, if you want to like see kind of the origin of this phase of it, there's actually documentation.
Well, here's the thing. What if like he's on the train in Germany, the 20s, and you go through that scene and he runs into a man and he's about to bite him, then he realizes it's Magnus Hirschfeld.
Right.
But he sees someone so evil that he cannot bite him.
You know, you want to see the origin of this, go to Billy Wilder's, you know, the crazed Hollywood director's videos of Buchenwald, right? Yeah. And he has scenes of them, of the Europeans leaving the camp after they've been exposed to the horror show that they've set up, these artificial props where they've got the fake shrunken heads and the fake human skin lampshade, you know, and these things are just, I mean, now you can look at them and laugh. But then the film was set up to record the horror in the faces of the European. Mm-hmm. Well, what is the point of this? They're trying to imprint into, you know, the next generations of Europeans, this horror, right? So that you have this automatic reaction as when you're exposed to this kind of Jewish, you know, Holocaust porn and the subsequent, you know, levels of propaganda as just automatically true and real, mm-hmm. right? Look at the faces of these people, except if you look at the videos, you'll see that about 1 out of 10 people is laughing because the propaganda just didn't quite take. So when you get to the horror film, you know, 70 years later, where the vampire won't suck Adolf Hitler's blood, I mean, you see that the propaganda has really, you know, kind of gone to sort of a more or less debased place. You know, Tim, I wanted to digress, if you don't mind. I spent the week, for some reason, I pick up these, you know, hobbies, and they last as long as my attention span and then disappear. I was studying the F-35, the $1.7 trillion sixth generation jet that's going to be, you know, defending us in the future. And I mean, the thing doesn't work at all. They've got their first kind of results in of like long-term usage, and the people are saying, you know, there's a problem here in that the plane is actually only able to be flown about half the time. The other half of the time it doesn't seem to like work, and it's kind of dangerous to take these things up in the air, which of course we found out last week is not, you know, theoretical, when that pilot ejected and then the plane crashed like over 80 miles away from the injection point, and they couldn't find the plane for several days, right? I mean, so you can see that, I mean, this is just ludicrous. It's almost, when you think about that episode, it almost seems impossible.
But there's no radar in this thing?
You couldn't find the plane. There, it doesn't have some kind of transponder.
There's no tracking on these things?
Why would the pilot eject, you know, before 80 miles worth of traveling it could do, you know, before it crashed? Anyway, this is just a, you know, very sorry state. And it shows where the military is, that the rot that we see in the political class and the media and in the universities is inside the military, too. There's no question.
Yeah, it's needlessly complex, cost plus contracting. It's a boondoggle. And it's, again, you can say it's not really, it wasn't designed to defend the country. It's there to run the bill up. And that's the your military industrial complex. And that's fed by the central banking system, debt inflationary system. The whole NATO expansion was because a large motivation for NATO expansion was running up military spending. You know, that's why Lockheed Martin would support think tanks and media PR campaigns to expand NATO eastward to, because once countries become NATO countries, they have to upgrade their military and buy weapons.
Well, the whole idea of the fighter plane fighter jet is, you know, an artifact of like World War II. And really now it's just propaganda because, I mean, first of all, the modern...
What about Top Gun and Tom Cruise and all that stuff?
That's a great movie, but they aren't going to work over the Ukraine where they have these integrated air defenses and they can shoot you down with hypersonic missiles. I mean, they say, well, we need F-16s for what? All that the jet planes can do at this point is fly at low levels so they're not detected, and then launch cruise missiles, which you could launch off of trucks. So they're absolutely useless. And
you can bomb Libya or something. You
know? That's right. What we are really good at, what the U.S. can do well, is attack a third world country with no modern technology and bomb the villages. But note that even in that aspect, ultimately we fail. I mean, think about Vietnam, think about Afghanistan. I mean, we can only keep up the pressure for maybe 10 years and then we give up. So we really, I mean, the military is given so much prestige in the United States. You know, you have the flyover during the Super Bowls, but really it's just a piece of junk at this point.
Well, isn't it like procurement? Some of the components are manufactured in like 350 different congressional districts and all
that. It's really the military. Yeah. I mean, the military is really just a function of the black box Federal Reserve where money just gets shoved into people's pockets. It's like this $1.7 trillion. That's the entire contract for the F-35. What? I mean, are you kidding me? $1.7 trillion? And the plane can't even be serviced. I was reading about the contractor who's supposed to do the maintenance, which they can't do. And they were going, well, there's 10,000 parts that we have to like work on here, 10,000. But we actually don't have the serial number, the identification numbers of the parts. And I was thinking, well, what are you going to do? Are you just going to make a guess that this part looks like it might work? It looks pretty good. Let's give it a shot. No wonder the things are falling out of the sky. The F-35 is, I mean, it'll be on display over the Super Bowl, but I don't think it's ever going to be in combat. I honestly don't think that it has. It's just useless against.
How about video games?
Video games, yeah. Tom Cruise movies and things like that. So it's just part of the artificial reality that Americans live in, you know, that we have this high-tech, high-efficient army. We don't. It doesn't exist.
That's good enough. We just keep the bluff going. That's good enough, right?
Yeah, I mean, really, the best army that the NATO countries had was the Ukrainian army. That was the best army that we had.
Well, from what I understand, that doesn't exist anymore.
It's gone. The Russians just absolutely decimated it.
Yes.
They're just, at this point, it's just depopulation. That war, you know, I've talked about this many times. I'm so upset about it.
Speaking of our artificial reality.
The war is fake. It's theatrical. They're just depopulating these poor Ukrainians.
Speaking of our artificial reality, there was a rumor this week that the senator from Pennsylvania, John Fetterman, had been replaced by a body double or not so double. Yeah. You see the photographs?
Yeah.
He does look different. I have to grant him that. Now, I don't know if that's angle or something, but I think the takeaway was that the new guy, the body double, was able to complete a sentence.
Yeah.
So
I think I hope the body double is given the job permanently.
I know celebrities, if you talk about it, we've heard about dictators as heads of state, and we heard World War II, Churchill having a body double, Hitler having a body double. Even celebrities having body doubles at events and these things. So it's not out of the sense of reality or out of, you know, not impossible that a politician might have a body double, whatever, for whatever reason. Now, someone as hulking, as odd looking as Fetterman would be hard to double up.
He'd be tough because he's such a strange looking creature. He looks kind of like Boris Karloff. Yeah.
But does it really matter though? I mean, I know he's brain damaged. I know that was sort of the idea that we have this not only do we have brain damaged people elected to the Senate, we have sort of this oxygenarian class now with Mitch McConnell, Pelosi, or of course our president, and it's how old our political class is and how dysfunctional. Dianne Feinstein is 90 years old, and her daughter has taken over power of attorney to pay her bills, but she's serving on Senate committees. I mean, this is ridiculous. This is like this gerontocracy. This is something that we saw in the Soviet Union in the 80s. Before its collapse, and
it's all part of the automated voting process.
The voting's fake, representation is fake. So does it matter?
You just have this like kind of corpse that they bring in front, and the vote then is handled by the oligarchs. You know, I mean, I don't know if you've caught this, but I think it's Pennsylvania. Josh Shapiro, I believe, is the governor.
Yes.
Shapiro. Now, when you register as a driver's license, get a driver's license, or in some other criteria, but one, certainly driver's license, you're automatically registered to vote.
Yeah.
It's just automatic. And then, of course, when you look at the automated ballot harvesting process of like Molly Ball and these people, you can see that the immigrants, when they come in to get ID papers, will automatically, you know, I mean, I don't know how their citizenship process will occur, but just in general, you can see we're moving more and more to the automated third world dictatorship where, you know, the affirmative action candidate will get 99% of the votes every single time. And that will always be 51% of the total votes needed, you know, for the, so you're really into just an electronic, it's sort of like the fiat currency, you know, that can't be audited. You have a fiat voting, which cannot be audited because that's racism and white terrorism. So the democracy, you know, which was an illusion, in fact, but is now becoming an automated illusion.
Well, even someone like Fetterman, who's mentally incapacitated, obviously, or Biden, who's president. Again, the fact that you have, or McConnell or Pelosi, you have this gerontocracy that's decrepit and feeble. This obviously serves the interest of the oligarchy and the special interests that control these politicians. So if you want a political managerial class, you don't want a class that has some gumption or sense of duty or even a sense of reality, because they can be manipulated. Like Dianne Feinstein is a great example. Obviously, it's the people behind her that are telling her to vote this way, that way, and that's the lobbyists. The, you know, talk about Congress or who controls Congress. Well, AIPAC and the Jewish lobby, Congress is bought and paid for. That's why Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli president get 30 standing ovations, you know. And even then, the idea, even the ones that aren't senile, the idea that they vote, they read, understand, and vote on legislation that they vote for is ridiculous. They don't. It's the lobbyist rights. A few years ago, I forget which congressman senator it was, but he pointed out his aide, I forget her name, but she was a healthcare. She worked for an insurance company. She wrote the bill that became Obamacare, and she was being praised for it. So she leaves that industry, works on Capitol Hill, writes the law, then leaves, goes back to the industry that's benefiting from the law that she wrote. No one congressman or senator even knew what they were voting on. It was like Nancy Pelosi said, we have to vote on it before we know what's in it. She actually said that. Nancy Pelosi said that more than 10 years ago. The legislation they vote on, they don't read. They don't know what's in it. No one can know what's in it. These things are 1,500 pages long, you know. So, again, the idea that you have someone like Fetterman up there who's incapacitated, does it really matter when you have a voting system which is so compromised, when you have a legislative process which is so corrupted by lobbyists and special interests and foreign special interests?
But you can see how modern it is. They have the gerontocrat individual who's really literally brain dead. I mean, like Feinstein or Biden, you know, McConnell. And then you have their automated voting process. It's all, at this point, it's literally electronic. I mean, it's becoming... Yeah. The democracy is becoming just like the creation of fiat credit. It just occurs automatically in computers, and there is just absolutely no way that democracy could ever look inside any of this stuff, because that would be racism, you know? So you now are in a position where, you know, in the old days, you at least had to use some guile, some corruption. There had to be some back channels, you know what I mean? There'd be something that you might actually be able to detect if democracy was alert. You know, you could see, well, Feinstein met with this group, and these are a lobbyist group for these people, and they're evil. And you'd have something, but now, that's gone. I mean, now you just have, it's just automated, you know, where just the electronic activity just produces her vote, and there you go. So I was going to mention, and I've just brought up the idea of the, you know, automated and fake currency. Well, look at, I think his name is Mendoza, is it? The guy was caught, you know, in the bribe money last week.
Oh, no, Menendez, New Jersey.
Menendez, right. Sorry, excuse me.
Bob Menendez,
But what I love is the fact he was taking gold bars.
Yes.
This is really a telltale sign where even the corrupt, you know, graft, they don't even like the dollar. You know, this should tell you where this all goes, you know.
He was representing Egypt. That's being reported. Right. Egypt. I'm sure Egypt is controlling things on Capitol Hill, right?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, yeah, so this just how corruption is. It's again, it's one of these things where who's devising policy. If you look at something like a policy like immigration, where the federal government is literally now conspiring to overwhelm the country with waves of illegal immigrants, and no one voted for that. If anything, if you look at it, whether any country, it's never been popular, and they elect politicians like Maloney in Italy and things. Biden certainly didn't campaign on opening up the borders, right? But it happens anyway.
Oligarchic control, yes, which is enforced by intimidation and accusations of racism. I mean, democracy has nothing to do with this. I mean, the idea of like bringing in 92%.
Yeah.
Young males in your immigrant cohort. Well, explain that, please. What are you actually trying to achieve here? So it's so ugly. It's so malevolent. You can't even have a democratic process because the population might actually wake up that, you know, to the idea they're being attacked. And these ideas are spinning in my head right now. I just wanted to mention that you're talking about Fetterman. You know, this is coming, or it's, once again, you're seeing QAnon hitting the news wires. And I'm just wanting to predict, you know, I usually have these predictions, which are typically wrong. QAnon will become more vivid as we go toward the election, the presidential election. I think it'll regenerate, even though it was completely debunked with 1-6, right? I mean, mm-hmm. QAnon led, think about all the rumors, the white hats, the generals, the Trumps. I mean, they had like, photographic evidence of QAnon people meeting with Trump. They, you know, they were like rings and people's hands and things, which were, you know, all these bizarre ways of identifying all this. It all turned out to be nonsense. It was just a cul-de-sac. I mean, QAnon, I think, really was probably a lot of different things, and there were different aspects of it, but primarily it was just done to bring about 1-6, which was, you know, their centerpiece for the propaganda, you know, to indicate that, you know, like.
Well, now the FBI says the FBI says they don't know how many informants are.
Yeah, they couldn't even do an audit. There was so many. I mean, I'd like that they should do. I mean, I'd like to see, well, who was the individual inside that was a regular, you know, citizen? I guess those are the ones who were under arrest, mm-hmm. the 1,000. But I'm pretty sure, I mean, I'm guessing that QAnon will come back, you know, with, you know, to, they're obviously, you know, if they're going to run Trump again, looks like that's a shoo-in at this point. Even if, and incidentally, I had a discussion with an attorney about this, that even if Trump is convicted, he can still be elected president and then pardon himself from prison. So,
as a president, sitting as a former president, he has Secret Service details, so they'd have to go to prison with him, right?
Yeah, that's right. And then, but then he could pardon himself. But, you know, I would love to see like the inauguration held inside some kind of federal penitentiary, you
that's
know,
true.
With all of the inmates gathered around instead of like, you know, the corrupt politicians, you could get like the Aryan Brotherhood and the Crips and things, and they could be gathered around the president as he was being sworn in. This is theatrical. This is not, they're debasing democracy. They're taking us away from the idea of.
Well, talking about debasing, did you see where they changed the dress code in the Senate for the benefit of Fetterman? He can wear, I guess he can wear a Carhartt hoodie on the Senate floor and shorts. And so, you know, debasing goes both ways.
But this is the first step because you're moving into an illiterate society.
It's idiocracy. Yes.
Of action because bear in mind, they had that result in 13 or something, 15 Baltimore schools, where they mentioned that there wasn't a single student, and not a single student, that was able to pass a test indicating proficiency at mathematics. Not a single student, zero. Think about how many just genetically talented individuals would have been in that total cohort. Think about how destructive the educational process has to be.
Well, proficiency is white supremacy. So proficiency is white supremacy, Joe.
Of course it is.
You know, so you can't. That's just, you can't have that. You know, but apparently they spend a lot of money there.
Oh my God, it's through the roof.
Yes.
And now, of course, that they have this result, what will be the response? Well, we're not spending enough. You know, there has to be, you know, more self-esteem programs in order to gin up the math scores. What they're going to do will be to get rid of the math tests. That's where this goes.
Well, they reward failure. I mean, in New York, to receive a $1 million settlement, all you had to do was fail the proficiency test to be a teacher, because there are too many white teachers. That's basically what they said. That's their argument. Too many white teachers, too many people of color failed the test. It's not incumbent upon the people of color to improve their intellectual educational abilities. It'll lower the standards.
So going forward, you're going to have not just hoodies, but basically the, you know, whatever legislation or judicial activity that is taking place, it's going to have to be held on TikTok, because they won't be able to read anything, right? So you're going to have very short, because of the attention span, TikTok presentations, which will be interspersed with pornography just to keep the attention of the senators. I mean, you know, you know, the future of America, honestly, you know, is looking pretty weak at this point. The F-35s falling from the sky and the hoodies showing up in the Senate. I mean, these are your indicators of where you're going to go. So you'd better.
Well, entertaining, because in the meantime, we have like videos of Lauren Boebert getting felt out in the movie theater in Colorado.
Yeah.
It's like, so the debate, it's the basement goes across the aisle here, the debasement rather.
Yeah.
You know, because again, it's, and then you have the Democrats acting outraged at the behavior. Is it, wait a second, aren't you the guys who are advocating like transgenderism and all
that? So the great achievement of the Biden administration is the transgender. It's surprising, isn't it? Because there were a few problems that you would think would have caught his attention at the beginning of his tenure, but they didn't. And so now you have the Ukrainian morass, which is interesting, isn't it? I mean, you can already see how it may never completely go to zero, but it's going to wind down with just the U.S. walking away from the mess.
Yeah, there are elements, I think, within the CIA and also the ruling, perhaps the WASP elite, that remains them. They don't like it. This is a Jewish thing at this point. Yeah. The Ukrainian thing is a Jewish project from the get-go. And there are elements within the American establishment who don't want to support it anymore. Yeah. Neocon, sorry.
That's right. Dog whistle for us, please. Yeah, it's neocon. It's 100% neocon, and Nuland and Zelensky and Mololinsky and all of the people that brought this about, they just have blood all over their hands and they could care less. Just remember that. Remember when you see like Nuland, you know, in the, you know, and her ilk making presentations in the media, you know, remember that in back of that hideous face is a, you know, a skull representing hatred and death, because they knew perfectly well there was no way that they could not have seen this moment where NATO's out of, you know, it's not producing munitions at a rate that was equal to the Ukrainians' fire capacity or need. And therefore, they're just going to be ground down and destroyed, and they're going to lose, well, everyone. How many Ukrainians are going to be left when this thing, I mean, inside the country? I don't know. They will need a real insertion of immigrants, won't they, Tim? Won't the country will be desperate for to replace the you know, the white male workforce that has been exterminated? So they're going to have to do quite a bit of immigration here in the future. This is all being brought about to save Ukraine.
Oddly enough, the United States is not very receptive of like white South Africans who want to emigrate to
Yeah,
the
I don't
United
know
States.
why. Isn't that funny?
They're not among the Africans teeming into the country.
They're the only Africans that can immigrate. It's almost impossible to get a green card if you're European in the United States. Very, very difficult. So, you know, they have a multicultural vision because it produces a
Well,
clump.
here's the thing. Boil it down to this: is demographic stability the key or the foundation for political stability? Well, yeah, it is, because they're the people, and obviously, the more demographic instability you have, you get, the more social or political instability you have. So, if the primary purpose of the state is to maintain political stability, law and order in the country, then it has to work to maintain demographic stability. If the regime is dedicated to promoting demographic instability, then the regime itself is promoting political instability, and that regime itself is illegitimate. And it's not
Well,
racist
I
to
would
not
say you're
make
absolutely
that
right.
acknowledgement. So.
And the regime is illegitimate because they don't identify who they really are or who they really have allegiance to. So the political regime in America, I mean, for hundreds of years has been to some extent illegitimate because it doesn't disclose the Masonic control over it. You know, it doesn't discuss it. It doesn't talk about the power of the oath that they have
Well,
taken
that's
in
true. I
America.
mean, obviously, now it's more obvious than ever, perhaps. But look at throughout American history, going back, none of its wars or its foreign policy entanglements were carried out or executed. It's foreign policy in the interest of the American people. It's for the interest of the few people who happen to have control of the government at the time. That's a bitter pill to swallow, maybe, because you have to like reject all the propaganda. Look at World War One, World War Two, the Spanish-American War, even the so-called American Civil War. None of these wars were prosecuted with the interest of the people. You know, if
Oh,
you these
and you know,
yes.
it's like last week, I think I was talking about Chile, and you know, I got emails criticizing me because, you know, they're saying, well, it's kind of far-fetched, it's sort of an interesting idea, but, and I respond, I go, look, Pinochet and Allende were from the same Masonic lodge, right? This much we can agree on. We know they are high level and they are oath-taking individuals. Where is your citation for what the oaths are? This is what you first have to do if you really want to get into an analytic process here. What are the oaths? What are they swearing to do? Because then you can make sense out of what comes later on, right? You know how powerful the oaths are and what the oaths are specifically. Then you can say, well, I see now what they are doing here. They're working a project against the Chilean people. It becomes vivid, but you have to have the disclosure on the beginning of it. You know, so when you look at our process, fine, you know, you wonder, well, George Washington, just start with the idea he is a Mason, he's taking oaths. We don't know what the oaths are, therefore we can't really assess accurately what in the heck his behavior is actually intended to produce, any more than we can assess financial, you know, kind of structure in America without being able to audit the Federal Reserve. We just don't know. You know, we have to demand some clarity on these things. You can't elect people who have backgrounds in secret societies without knowing what the power of the secret society is over the individual. You know, you mentioned earlier Reagan and how he was responsible, even though he's held up as this, you know, great American. Well, remember, it isn't just, you know, his immigration disaster, but remember, he's the one who like began the process of releasing lunatics into the streets, right? He was absolutely the person who started that process in California. So, you know, then you go, well, he's Bohemian Grove. Okay, it's a secret society. What is it? What is actually being represented with the politician?
Well, both Reagan and Pat Brown represented, Jewish billionaires. At least they were frontmen for Jewish billionaires. And got different.
Exactly.
Now you can say arguably different factions of Jewish billionaires.
Yeah.
But this is where you get the idea of the lodge and the Freemasonry, is that the whole modern world operates under pre-Masonic presuppositions. It's the whole the liberal order is applied Freemasonry, and that gets into a broader sweep of history, I guess you could say, where this whole the modern world has adopted Freemasonic principles, and so you go from there. It's like the revolution itself. When they say Freemasonry isn't so much, I mean, obviously there was an anti-Freemason party in the United States. There was a recognition of this. There was, you know, that anti-Masonic party, but it was a revolutionary technology or strategy that was employed particularly by the British Empire. So it is a strategy. And but the idea that it's not so much obsolete as it is regnant, meaning that it's the world we live in now. And there was the Duke de Orleans, who was an aristocrat who turned against the ancient regime and was eventually, executed in the revolution. But he said, in terms of Freemasonry, that Freemasonry is the candle, the revolutionary candle that provides the light. But when the sun comes up, the candle is no longer necessary in the sun of revolution. So once that becomes adopted by everybody, it's no longer as, but it's only because its systems have been integrated into everyone's, it's been into the structure of society, into how we look at things. And that's liberalism itself. So
the system of intimidation, you know, and propaganda, that you don't have to have the lodge system any longer. You just have the media.
Yeah,
that's the lodge. It's now with the internet and the iPhone, there's the lodge. You know, that's where the, you know, you can hurl out the meme to control, and then you set up these theatrical things like with Russell Brand, right? Where he's fallen from a high place. Just the assertion of something, you know, enables him to be brought down. So.
Yeah, I don't get that. Where I'm not surprised that he was a whoremonger in his youth because he was rich and famous. And when men are rich and famous and young, and women throw themselves at him, I don't know if he ever had to resort to what he's being accused of. The bottom line is, you can't come with an accusation 15, 16 years later, just with a mere accusation, and expect that to be any basis for like a criminal proceeding. It's just is what it is. You know, yeah, I don't know him. So,
you know, but going forward, when you have feminism, like being outraged over some, you know, male activity that if a politician that they want to destroy or
what's
cancel,
selective,
this just adds to the intimidation. It just adds to the umbrage and you know, the arched eyebrows and the cowering white male who doesn't want to stand up to any of, even just the threat of having a charge hurled. It's like anti-Semitism, is that you don't even have to say it into some cases. You know,
aren't these the same people advocate like drag queen story hour and the sexual mutilation of children and the it's hard for me to get you're gonna get morally offended by what, you know, what some pseudo B level celebrity might have done 15 years ago. I mean, come on.
Particularly when the accusations are like decades old and weren't made to the police at the time.
Yeah, there's a reason why there's a statute of limitations.
And literally at this point, it's not even he said, she said, because there's how would Brand be able to disprove this? Where is the chain of evidence? I mean, literally all what this does is just show you the power of accusation. It's there to show the power of accusation, not the process, not the legal process of disclosure and, you know, like convicting someone. This just underlines the power of accusation. And that's just the way that the modern herd is kept in check. It's just a cattle prod, you know, that look at this. We just the accusation and he's canceled. He's banned. He can't even raise any money. I've never liked this guy. I always thought he was dirty. And I just think, like Harvey Weinstein, I think they set these things up to promote the power of accusation.
Well, I mean, obviously, he marketed off that him being sort of, you know, the cad, the clever British cad with the accent and all that stuff. And it's supposed to be cute and all that, you know, whatever. Again, he's just and apparently he's like he took positions like on the vaccine and the pandemic, which might have he ran afoul of certain interests. So now his transgressions matter, whereas in the past it didn't matter, you know. So
they set these people up, you know, when you see them in the media, when suddenly they're overnight, you know, like Robert Malone, and they're it's really good idea to be skeptical and to wonder if this isn't just a cul-de-sac, if it isn't just someone who's who's there to take control of what is bound to exist in terms of opposition to something that's heinous and irrational by the government or by, you know, some organization, but they will control the opposition so that you can take the hatred of what has happened with the vaccine all the way up to where you will accuse the deep state or big pharma, you see, or some, you know, meaningless, you know, depiction, some word salad that doesn't take you anywhere and then stops the process of thinking. So you don't actually go after the individual or group who's doing this and then try to come up with some understanding of motivation. You don't see the deliberate genocide. You don't see the race aspect of any of this because you end up with deep state, big pharma, and the whole word salad stuff, which is the conclusion of the ability of the public to think.
Right? Yeah, you overly mystify it or something. So then you...
Yeah.
Yeah. And so at the same time, you create a kind of a relief pressure valve. You know, so people think they're saying something meaningful and they're not. So... Yeah. And of course, there's no course of action, which is the key thing.
Well, that's the main thing.
Is there's paralysis. No, yeah. I mean,
if there's going to be action, it's 1-6.
Well, name a name, and I can name a few names.
You're into a cul-de-sac, and then Pence doesn't deliver the goods, and there you are, naked and exposed.
Well, how about this? You subpoena the evidence, the communications, the emails of like the ADL, and you bring on a RICO case based on that evidence and prosecute the hell out of them. There's right. action, and you, by There's the way, a DA could do that, but they're not doing it.
Of course not. Are that they? Would be racism, yeah.
That would be anti-Semitism.
It would be Holocaust denial.
And I'm sure Jeff Greenblatt and people working at the ADL have relatives who died in the Holocaust, so we can't do it.
Yeah, they have so many. You wonder how they're in existence now. You know,
like, they've
been... I guess they all their progenitors escaped. You know, with the
yes, and victims can never victimize, apparently. You know, right? So it never turns out that way. Okay, Joe.
Hey, Tim, good talking to you, brother. Have a great day, great weekend.
Take care, bye bye.
Yeah, we'll talk next week. Bye bye.